So the advantage of being the last speaker is that only the smartest people are left in the audience. So I'll try to raise the level appropriate. This is not a summary talk, but I am going to try and kind of point back to a lot of the talks that already happened here, at least the ones that overlap with what I'm talking about. But there's some things like Higgs that don't overlap, so I'm not going to. So if you gave a Higgs talk, I'm sorry, I'm not going to refer to you. What I am going to do is walk you through the results of this recent paper with these collaborators. And I just want to point out that two of us are theorists and two of us are experimenters, so I think that's already an accomplishment in itself. I will start with the LHC inverse problem, which you already know about. I'm going to introduce that in the context of missing energy lookalikes. Then the most sexy example that we've looked at is starting to discriminate SUSY from non-SUSY with small data samples. And then I'll give the caveats and improvements and things that need to be done. So Gordy, I think, said this very well in his talk. The long-term goal of the LHC program is to extract the parameters of the terascale Lagrangian and to use this to learn as much as possible about the higher scale theory, whether it's string theory or whatever is up there, and not to mention other things like dark matter and baryogenesis. In the short term, of course, we're not going to do all that. What we're going to try and do is discover some kind of signals beyond the standard model and begin the process of characterizing what the underlying theory is. A lot of work has been done on characterizing what I'll call the zeroth order characterization of the model, which is just set by the fact that if I discover something in a certain signature, I already know something about it from the way I discovered it. So there's a lot of work on that. There's a lot of work on what I would call sort of second and third order characterization, but not so much work on what I would call first order characterization. So this is you make a discovery in some signature, and you want to know sort of right away what direction should I be going in terms of the theoretical explanation. And both Nima and Natalia already talked about this problem. So you already heard about it. Here's a quote from Ian. There's lots of models now, but large numbers will be dead on arrival as soon as we get data. That is certainly true. On the other hand, many models will not be dead on arrival given any particular signal in a particular analysis in a particular detector. There will certainly be lots of lookalike models, at least at first, that all explain that signal. And so our initial job post-discovery is to start discriminating these lookalikes. If we can't do that, we're not going to get anywhere. Now, if there's lots of different possibilities, we all know that theory space is very big. You might be worried that this is going to take a very long time. And so the analogy I like to use is the game of 20 questions, which any 12-year-old knows how to play. And even though you have n, where n is a very large number of possible alternatives, you can nevertheless get to the right answer after a order log n steps, as long as you ask the questions in the right way. Now, to do this at LHC, we're going to have to know a lot about the theory space that we're trying to navigate in, so that requires smart theorists. And we're also going to have to know a lot about the data, which is going to require smart experimentalists. So I don't know if that's asking too much, but that's what we're going to need. Another thing about this analogy with 20 questions is that when you're playing this game, you don't worry about what the question number 18 is going to be until you know what the answers were to questions number 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And I think the same thing is true here. The real urgency is to design the first few questions, and then depending on what the answers are to that, we can worry about what the questions are that come later on. So here's an example of a question that's certainly important, but it's not so obvious whether it's question number 1 or question number 18. And this is one of the things we need to sort out. So what we showed in our study, and I'll go through some of the details of this, is that at the moment of an early missing energy discovery, where by early I'll define that to be 100 inverse picobarns, it will be possible to discriminate many SUSY models from many non-SUSY lookalike models. And I'll show you exactly what I mean by lookalike. On the other hand, we don't claim that you'll be able to do this completely, so presumably there will be other lookalikes that are not immediately eliminated. Now, in the long run, we know what we're really going to do is you're going to do direct measurements of the spins and charges and couplings of all these new partner particles that you found, and you'll eventually know what everything is. This we've already done in the past, and we know it takes a long time. For the top quark, for example, it's been 10 years before we really did. In fact, we haven't completed doing all this yet for the top quark. So it takes about 10 years to actually do the things you eventually need to do to understand the parameters of the underlying Lagrangian. And the point I want to make is that this 20 questions process won't wait 10 years. We need to know some, we need to have some guidance before that about questions like, is it SUSY? All right, so let's apply this now in a very particular context. I'm going to assume that we make a discovery. So in this case, that means a 5 sigma excess. It's observed in an inclusive missing energy search at the LHC in one or both experiments, with the first 100 Imrys picobarns or less, possibly, of understood data, and understood here is in a different color to emphasize what you've already heard, which is that these missing energy searches are very difficult. In fact, maybe I should clarify that a little bit. As Constantine said, it's certainly much harder to make a missing energy discovery than to find a resonance. On the other hand, I think it's easier to make a missing energy discovery than it is to get this accelerator and the detectors working in the first place. So assuming that we're actually going to succeed in doing that, I think that if there is a signal, sort of PEV-ish, strongly produced partners with cross-sections of a picobarn or more, I think that a missing energy discovery will actually happen within the first couple of years. So supposing that that does happen, you want a strategy to rapidly narrow the list of candidate theories, not the unique theory necessarily, but to narrow the list, and you want to do it as rapidly as possible. And you want to do it, you want to have a strategy that doesn't assume that you know how to do everything, because this is fairly early running of the experiment. So in order to do a lookalike analysis, I have to know what the discovery data set is, and in order to do that, I have to know what the analysis was that I applied to make the discovery. So for missing energy, I'm going to assume that I did a particular missing energy analysis, and this is the one that appears in the CMS Physics TDR, so you can go look it up and read about it. And I won't go into the details of what it is, but the basic idea here is that you look for large missing energy in association with jets, energetic jets. And the other important point is that this is what they call an all-hadronic search. Not only are no leptons required in this search, but in fact there's an indirect lepton veto that helps to suppress the Standard Model background. So we're relying here on missing energy and jets. There will be some leptons in the things I talk about, but in fact very few lepton handles. Now, of course, backgrounds are one of the big problems with this sort of analysis. We have used the full simulation estimates of these backgrounds that appear in the TDR. This is the estimated number of background events after you perform all these cuts per inverse femtobarns. So divide these by 10 for 100 inverse picobarns. So that's encouraging. They're small. Now the question is whether they're realistic. A good data point is that we've already done these kinds of searches at the Tevatron, so we know what the answer is for the Tevatron. And in the Tevatron, you've got very similar sort of background rejection as is projected here for the LHC. So that's, I think, our strongest optimistic data point. On the other hand, this is coming from a full simulation of the CMS detector that has not been validated against data. So until you do that, you just don't know how to put a realistic error bar in these backgrounds. So we're going to take these background estimates, and even though they might be wrong, fortunately, the results that we're going to obtain would not be seriously compromised, even if you doubled or tripled them. So I think we have a lot of breathing room here. Okay, so you have an analysis. You also have to have some kind of detector simulation. Again, you really need to do this with a full detector simulation. We're doing that within CMS, but you can't see any results from that. So what I'm showing you is the results from our paper, which are done with a parameterized generator-level simulation that is tuned for this type of analysis to reproduce the kind of performance that you got for the most relevant physics quantities in the full simulation. And this is just a little table showing you that our parameterized simulation does pretty well. The main thing that you're parameterizing here that's really important for this analysis is you're taking a generator-level jet, and you're making it look more like real jets look in the full simulation of the detector. Now, of course, that means I have some definition of what a jet is. There's questions about, you know, what kind of jets you're going to really use in this analysis. So let me not get bogged down by details. All right. So now I said I should be realistic about what I assume I can reconstruct and use in this kind of analysis in the early running. If I'm, you know, doing this after an inverse adabarn of data, presumably I can reconstruct anything that's there, including the pink elephants. But in this era, that's presumably not going to be true for at least some things. So the most conservative assumption I can make is that the only things that I really have a handle on are the things that I used to make the discovery in the first place. So in this analysis, the things I had to have in order to make the discovery in the first place was I needed a handle on missing transverse energy, not small missing transverse energy, which is going to be really hard, but in sort of this intermediate range. I don't need to know what it looks like at 2 TeV or at 30 GeV, but I need to know how to understand net in sort of this intermediate range. Similarly, I need to know something about jets. I don't need to know about very soft jets, but I need to be able, at least in this analysis, which requires three or more jets, I need to be able to count jets of that type with some degree of reliability. I don't need to know too many detailed information about jets, but I need to know something about them. Now, you might not think that I need muons since this analysis didn't involve leptons. But in fact, to calibrate the backgrounds, which you need to do in order to understand whether you made a discovery, you do need muons. You need muons to calibrate the electroweak backgrounds. So we will have to know something about muons, but not necessarily details about isolated muons and not necessarily soft muons. So I'm only going to talk about muons here that have PT of at least 20 GeV. Similarly, if you don't have any tracking, you're probably not going to be able to claim this kind of a discovery. So I'll assume that I at least can do charge tracks with PT above some threshold, but it doesn't really matter what it is. Now, one thing that's missing from this list is obviously is electrons. You probably will need electrons, too, in order to calibrate the backgrounds. I think it was David Stewart in the audience commented the other day that muons are easier at CMS, which is one reason why you see muons and not electrons in a list like this. But the real reason here is that we're actually trying to orthogonalize what we're doing from the standard thing that's already well studied. If I have lots of leptons and lots of muons and lots of electrons, you can make all these nice dileptron edges and stuff, and life is much easier. So we don't need to study that. It's already done by smarter people than us. You need a trigger in order to make a discovery. This analysis we're talking about has a missing energy trigger, but there's other triggers you can talk about, and not to get bogged down in triggers. We did consider three other triggers you might use. These are just triggers that we made up. They're not official CMS things that involve two very energetic jets, three very energetic jets, or a muon, actually asking for a muon as a trigger. And what's interesting about these things is because of our strong missing energy requirement, the subsamples that correspond to these triggers, the samples that correspond to these triggers are the subsamples of the overall discovery data set that we've defined here. So if you like, these are just names that apply to subsamples of the discovery data set that have certain properties. So that's a useful thing to have in mind. Okay, at some point you need some models in order to start making lookalikes. So what models are you going to use? You've already seen this table, I think, twice now. These are the MSUGRA benchmark SUSY models that are used in CMS, and there's a whole bunch of them, and it doesn't matter what they are. And of course, it would be bad for us to ignore these benchmarks since they're the CMS benchmarks, but it would also be bad for us to only use those because they have many limitations which you've already heard about. So what we did is we've used some of these benchmarks and we've generated them in the approved CMS way with ISAJET 769, but then we have also generated other SUSY models using SUSPECT, and then we've generated one class of non-SUSY models. These are actually littlest Higgs models with T-parity implemented in MagGraph. And for the case, another important point about generators, when we're comparing little Higgs models to SUSY models that are lookalikes, we do the generation, the event generation in the same way using MagGraph into Bridge, into Pythia. So we're comparing apples with apples. Okay, so what does it mean to be a lookalike? I don't mean lookalikes in the sense of a Lagrangian. I don't mean lookalikes in the sense of the spectrum. I mean lookalikes in the following sense. I define a signature, some kind of trigger, a set of analysis cuts, the integrated luminosity that defines my data set, the detector where all this is happening, the backgrounds and the systematics for the analysis. And then given all that, I can then tell whether two models could explain the same excess or not. So lookalikes is tied to a particular kind of analysis. So if I don't know the analysis, I don't know who's a lookalike. And then there's some tolerance that you allow. We allowed 2 sigma based on our error estimates that I'll describe in a minute. 2 sigma is just some arbitrary tolerance. Okay, so that defines the lookalikes. Now I would like to define some physical observables that I can use to discriminate between these lookalikes. So what am I going to use? So I said I only want to use things that I know for sure have to be available because otherwise I couldn't make the discovery. So what are examples of such things? Well, I said I had to be able to count jets in order to make this discovery. So I could make the following ratio. I could look at the number of events after all the cuts that have at least 4 jets and take the ratio of that to the number of events that have at least 3 jets. So that's what more generally you would call a ratio of inclusive counts, right? Because every event that has 4 jets also has 3 jets. So ratios, of course, are robust things. Errors tend to cancel in ratios. For example, luminosity errors cancel completely in a ratio like this, luminosity uncertainties in the experiment. Other kinds of systematic errors like PDF uncertainties cancel at least partially in ratios like this. So ratios are very good things. Obviously, if you want something that's robust and you can use it in the early running, ratios are good to use. We, in fact, in this analysis, use nothing but ratios. So every observable that we use in this analysis is defined as a ratio of some inclusive count of something. Yes? Yeah, 10 to 1 is about right, yeah. Yeah. I'll show you actual numbers and then you can compare it back to those background estimates. Now, when I said everything's a ratio of a count, you might say, well, what about things that have shape? So here's some examples of kinematic distributions that you've already seen. This is this M effective, which NEMA, among others, was using. Everybody uses this for LHC. This has a peak and it has a tail. There's a similar variable called HT. It has a peak, it has a tail. So I want to use this information in some way, but what way? So our perhaps too pessimistic idea is that it's going to be fairly hard to estimate, at least at first, how to attach uncertainties to details of these shapes. So we're actually doing something more primitive, which is we just take these plots and we divide them up into two or three bins, and then we define ratios based on how many events are in each bin. So what I call M-effective in this analysis is a ratio of the number of events after all the cuts that are above 1,400 on this plot compared to the number that are below 1,400. And 1,400 is just picked so that you have event, you know, statistics in both bins. It's not picked according by looking at the model. So that's a very crude way of handling this, but it's a way of keeping some of the information in here without getting into the detail. Another thing you're interested in is in the characteristics have to do with the shape of the event. And here, the thing that we started with is what's called hemisphere separation. So there's an algorithm that we took from Philippe Mourcat and Luke Popp, which attempts to take the reconstructed objects and divide them up into two sets, which they call two hemispheres. And basically, this represents the fact that you think there's a two goes to two process, and there's two decay chains, and you're trying to decide who goes in which decay chain. Now, as you might imagine, that is not that separation, although I called it hemispheres, is not always a geometric separation. But nevertheless, you have some algorithm that tries to do that. That algorithm, you can then look at simulated events and see how well it does. And how well it does depends on what you're looking at. So for example, for unselected TT bar events, if I look at where the original top quark was pointing versus where the reconstructed hemisphere from the decay is pointing, they're pretty close together in A to phi space. But if I look at our SUSY models, where I don't expect to do as well, you don't do as well in this hemisphere separation. So there's some kind of way of separating, there's an algorithm for separating the event into two pieces, but it's not 100% accurate, as you would imagine. Because there's two hemispheres, and one of them is, the way this algorithm works, there's a leading hemisphere and a subleading hemisphere, and the leading hemisphere is always better. You always do a better job. Now once you have a hemisphere separation, you can define this famous MT2 variable. And I have three nice slides that explain exactly what MT2 is, but I'm going to skip them because I don't have time. But let me just give you the very, very short version of MT2. The idea is that you have a parent particle. It decays into something or multiple somethings that you see and reconstruct into something that you don't see. And then the idea is you do what MT2 is a transverse mass estimate, which has the very nice feature that at the end of the day, it gives you a distribution of this transverse mass estimate that has an upper endpoint. And the property of this upper endpoint is that it is an estimate of the parent particle mass. So in this case, this is for one of our actual models. The parent particle mass was 589 GeV, so that's here. And you see that indeed there is something like an endpoint feature here around that mass. So the nice thing about MT2 is that it's a kinematic distribution, but it has a feature which gives you a direct extraction of one of the underlying parameters. So that's very nice, but of course, as you see in reality, and this isn't even reality, this is just starting to get towards reality, the endpoint is not perfect. For us, the main reason it's not perfect is that our hemisphere separation is not perfect. MT2 wants to know which visible thing went in which decay chain, and we don't always know what that is. Even if this is perfect, the hemisphere separation, it's still not a perfect endpoint because of initial state radiation and other effects. But nevertheless, this is a very useful and interesting variable, and we're going to make a lot of use of it here. The other thing I should point out is that with our small data samples, we don't actually populate the endpoint, so we sort of poop out around here. But nevertheless, the fact that this is heading towards the endpoint is enough for us to get information. Okay, I said that we're trying not to get leptons, and indeed we succeed in not getting leptons. we looked to see whether we had any obvious dileptone edges in any of the analysis that we did here, and with the 100 inverse picobarn, we don't. The only lepton feature that we see is that we have some models that have a lot of Zs from second neutralino decays, and we get a Z peak from those. And that's the only lepton, that's the only dileptone feature that appeared in any of the comparisons that I'll show you. A couple other things which are interesting. I have not assumed here that we know how to B-tag. Now, maybe we will know how to B-tag, and that's great. But even if you don't know how to B-tag, you would like to have something that allows you to discriminate between two models, one of which has a zillion Bs and the other one of which doesn't have any Bs. So this is asking a different question from what the experimentalists are usually trying to do. We just want to know, is there something I can validate early on that gives me some separation between highly enriched B samples and things that don't have Bs? So we started playing around with some simple algorithms, and we sort of went backwards in time, and we played with an algorithm that, instead of doing vertex tagging for bees, just looks for muons inside jets. This is what TDF used to do in the old days. And so we just played with the simplest thing we could think of and just to see how it looks for the signals that we're looking at. And as you might expect, it has a low efficiency for actual bee jets from SUSY models. It has a pretty good purity, although I don't know what you would call pretty good. That means 30% of the things we call bee jets are not bee jets with this sort of algorithm. And we did a similar thing for taus. You would like to be able to tell the difference between a model in which everything has taus and a model in which there aren't any taus. And so is there some kind of simple algorithm that might be able to give you that early on? And so, again, we tried the simplest thing we could think of. I won't give you the details. And again, the efficiency, well, the efficiency is a little better here than it was for the B-tagging. The purity is not as good. And the basic observation you make is that models that do have lots of taus, this SUSY model here, which I'll come back to, has a zillion taus in it, also give you the best efficiency and purity for this sort of poor man's tau tagging. So these are things that we just are meant as suggestions of things to play with for the real experiment. All right, now if you can't put error bars in any of this stuff, then you can't do these lookalike discriminations because you don't know what's the discrimination. So we have an error analysis, and again, I just want to point out the most important things. Really, it's this theory systematic error here is the most important thing. In particular, Frank already talked about this. Thank you. PDF errors are potentially very important here, and I'm going to show you that. But let me just say here that what we actually did was we ran the full analysis of three different PDFs that we chose in order to try and maximize the spread in the PDF values, and then we took an uncertainty that was half the spread that we got for each model, for each observable in each model. And the thing I want to show you, which I think is interesting, is how model-dependent and observable-dependent those PDF spreads are. So if somebody wants to go stare at this for a long time, I think there's a lot of physics to be gained from this slide, and we have another 100 slides like this, which I'd be happy to show you. So let me just orient yourself here. So this is breaking up the different errors here. So here's an example where I'm taking a ratio of muon counts. The largest error, this gray bar, is the statistical error, and that's because I don't have very many muons. So this is dominated by the statistical error. Whereas by statistics, I mean that I've taken one of the theory models to represent the data. Here's a case where I take a missing energy ratio. There's lots of events, so the statistical error is small. And also the systematic errors are pretty small. And one reason for that is because the PDF spread in this particular model for this particular ratio is small. It's a couple percent. But now look at here's another model, and here's the M effective ratio in that model. And here you see that, in fact, the theory systematic error, as we estimate it, is the dominant error over all the other errors here. And that's because for this particular model and this particular variable, the PDF spread is rather large. And the PDF spreads are all over the place. This all means something. So somebody that understood the PDFs and how to extract this physics, I think there's a lot to be learned by staring at this stuff. All right, but now we have to have more specific models. We took two groups of models. One of them is a set of SUSY models. These are MSUGA models. This is one of Steve Martin's compressed SUSY models. And this is just some other MSSM model that we cooked up that has a light galeno and very heavy squarks that you can't even see because they're too few. Okay, so that's just a bunch of SUSY models. Group two is the sexier case because here we have the little Higgs model. So this is a non-SUSY model. It's got these heavy quark partners and then these partners of the W and Z and the lightest partner down here. And then we compared that to three SUSY models. These two SUSY models actually are lookalikes of this little Higgs model in the missing energy analysis that we've adopted. I've also shown here the spectrum of another model, which is the SUSY model. It is not a lookalike in our analysis of the Little Higgs model, but the reason I've shown it is because it has the matching spectrum. It's the twin in terms of the spectrum of the Little Higgs model. So it has the squarks in the same place and the neutralinos in the same place. So the first thing I want to explain is why this model, which is the twin in terms of the spectrum, is not a lookalike. Well, Gordy already told us the answer to this, or part of the answer. So part of the reason is because the cross-section for these guys, even though they have the same spectrum in terms of masses, the cross-section depends on the spin, and then there's, in fact, about a factor of three difference in the total cross-section. Now, what we're doing here is we're looking at counts. We're looking at an excess, so that's cross-section times a signal efficiency after I do all these cuts. So I should also look at the difference in the efficiency. There's also a significant difference there. It goes the other way, in fact. The SUSY model has a higher efficiency to pass our cuts than the Little Higgs model. Now, this effect doesn't actually outweigh this effect, and so in the end, you get fewer of the SUSY events here that pass the total selection, and it's not a lookalike. But the moral of this story is that cross-sections and signal efficiencies depend on the matrix elements. The matrix elements depend on the masses, but they also depend on the spins of the parent particles. Yes? Yes. Oh, so a lot of the efficiencies in terms of these cuts, of course, since I'm using exactly the same cuts as in the discovery analysis, somebody else has already validated an error bar on those efficiencies, right? Because again, in order to make a discovery, I must have known something about the error bar on the cuts, right? So when I ask for three jets in the analysis, that kills some number of events. I need to know something about what the error bar was on that jet counting. So there, you're right, there's a whole bunch of uncertainties involved in these efficiencies, but somebody else, actually it's going to be the same people, but it's a prior step in this analysis to estimate what those error bars. So you're right, they're there, but it's not an additional thing in this lookalike analysis. Yeah, it's the hidden. Now, unfortunately for us, it's going to be the same people, so there's a nightmare there that has to be gotten through before you get to this stuff. I just wanted to make a very quick aside. In our appendix, where nobody's ever going to read it, we collected together a bunch of these leading order matrix elements just so you can compare them in the same notation, and we use the God-given notation of Ellis, Stirling, and Weber here in these terms of these dimensionless variables. And you notice here that there's an obvious SUSY relation between glue-glue goes to heavy quarks and glue-glue goes to squarks, because if I add this up, this junk cancels this junk, and I just get the prefactor. Now, in spite of the fact that these formulas are 30 years old, I have never seen anybody notice this before. Maybe somebody did and they didn't think it was important, and maybe it's not important. It's not an MSSM relation, because in the MSSM and the SUSY limit there aren't any heavy quarks, and it's not a Yang-Mills relation because there's no gluinos in these diagrams, but it's obviously a SUSY relation of some kind. So if somebody knows where that comes from, thank you. Come tell me. All right, but now let me get back to the results. Let me compare SUSY with non-SUSY for this group of models. All right, so we look at a bunch of ratios. We get a bunch of discrimination that we measure in sigma, but I also give you the raw counts here so you can see that when I say something is 5 sigma here, or almost 5 sigma, it's because in one case, the ratio is 3 times what it was in the other case. So, you know, I'm talking about factors of 2, factors of 3 differences. There are big differences here when I say that we can discriminate these things. And the other thing to notice here is that there's two variables that are showing up in this particular comparison. So this is a SUSY model with the Little Higgs model. One of them is this M effective, and the other is this several of these MT2 ratios. So what is that telling you? Well, in the case of the MT2, the MT2 ratios for the Little Higgs model are larger, and there's a reason they're larger. It's because the partner heavy quarks are heavier. So that's what MT2 is supposed to be doing, and it's doing that here. On the other hand, if you look at the M effective ratios, those are smaller for the Little Higgs model. So which is telling you, if I don't put in any other information, that in spite of the fact that it looks like the data comes from heavier parent particles, it looks like those events are less energetic. So if the only thing I do is fool around with the masses, it seems very, very puzzling that I get these two discrepancies going in opposite directions like this. Now, that's not a proof that I should go change the spin of my partners, but I would submit that it's a very strong clue. Another thing I could do, of course, is say, well, that was just one Suzy model. Let me take a qualitatively different Suzy model. Here's a qualitatively different Suzy model, which has Galeno production instead of squirk production. But as you might expect, that doesn't really work. It turns out by accident, it actually gets the kinematics right. And so we can't discriminate on the basis of things like M effective. But the MT2 is still wrong because this Galeno is too light compared to the little Higgs partners. And furthermore, Galeno events don't look like heavy quark or squirk events. They have different jet multiplicity and other features. Right? So it's not surprising that doesn't work. So that's not a proof that I can tell Suzy from non-Suzy, and we're not trying to do a proof. But what I'm trying to show you is that we can get some guidance about the underlying theory model with small data sets and without too much optimistic assumptions about what you can actually do. And in this particular case, part of that guidance traces back to the fact that we have sensitivity to things like spin in the underlying process. And in particular, this MT2 variable obviously is very helpful because MT2 just cares about the first approximation, the distribution, just cares about the mass, whereas other kinematic observables care about both the mass and other features that go into the matrix element. All right, so we did a whole bunch of other comparisons. Just give you a little summary here. Things in general are pretty good. Let me just, in the last couple minutes, concentrate on the worst cases, just so I'm not giving you a complete snow job. So here are the two worst cases. Worst case are two of these M. Suger models. These models are basically identical, except that this one has a light stau, and this one has a really light stau. So these guys look essentially identical, except that here everything decays to taus, and here they don't. The Chargino decays through a W. So these are very hard to tell apart because they're actually, in fact, almost identical, in fact, in reality. And indeed, what we find is that even with 1,000 inverse picobarns, the best discrimination we get with three sigma, and it's with this primitive tau ratio that we developed. The second case, which I want to explain, I'll explain in the next slide, we only get about a 4 sigma discrimination with 1,000 inverse picobarns. This one is a little less obvious why it's a problem. So I'm comparing now these two models. The spectra don't look all that much the same. But it turns out that the squirk, squirk, Galeno production fractions are all about the same. The Galenos both decay to top stop in both of these models. So they're actually quite difficult to tell apart. We discriminate them, as I said, at best at 4 sigma with 1,000 inverse picobarns. So this is kind of interesting because this model, this LM8, which is the CMS benchmark, has a 230 GeV Chargino. So I might be tempted to go to President Obama and get $10 billion for the ILC at this point. But in fact, if the data is really Steve's, this is Steve Martin's model, this is really a 352 GeV Chargino. So I'm just emphasizing the importance of getting this guidance accurately early on. All right, so let me, in the last minute, just give you some caveats and comments about what we're doing here. So one of the things that was assumed in everything I did here was that there were, in fact, two invisible particles per event. Now, you can generalize this analysis to other cases, and obviously you should. We had lots of talks here where people had models that had, for example, all the missing energy was from neutrinos, even though there were, it was a BSM model, but what it was producing was lots of neutrinos. So obviously this needs to be generalized. And just one note on that. We took this model LM2P, which has lots of taus. It also has lots of neutrinos. So just for fun, we did an artificial separation that you couldn't do in real life of the events that have just two LSPs and the events that have two LSPs and at least one energetic neutrino. And we just wanted to see what the MT2 distributions look like in the two cases to see if they look different. And they look different because MT2 cares about this. MT2 makes a hypothesis that there are two invisible particles, and if in reality there are three, it changes the distribution. So there are things to play with here that might give you some interesting results later on. Okay, and now a few caveats. There's all kinds of things you have to do better, and then having done better, you have to do error bars based on that. So for example, there are next to leading order corrections to the signals. It's not just the backgrounds where you have to worry about next to leading order, it's also the signals, as is already emphasized in other talks. This has at least three effects. It has a strong effect on the cross sections. In the group one analysis we did, we already included this by using Prospino. For the little Higgs, we think we can fake it using MCFM, but it isn't actually in the results I showed you. Next leading order also affects the shapes of the PT distributions, and that's something that we care about. This effect, at least according to these classic papers, is pretty small, so probably you can just, you know, attach an error bar to it and be happy. Another thing that you certainly care about is the correct modeling of extra hard jet emissions. That we're just going to have to do, and so again, we haven't done it yet, but this is the kind of thing you can do with MADGRAPH, and Jay actually talked about something very similar to what we're going to do. And then, of course, it's not just it's not just next leading order. You have to worry about the parton showers and God knows what else. Okay, so that's about it. Let me just conclude with a few more comments. So I think generally the results that we got are very encouraging, considering that we aren't using leptons and we're looking at very small data sets, 100 inverse picoburns, very small data sets. We had it's probably flashed by too fast. We had in the group one events, there were 200 signal events. In the group two case, there were 100 signal events. So these are very small data sets. The real power of this comes from the fact that you have robust observables and that there are many of them and that they are sensitive to different features of the models. All right. Now, we are not doing this right. What we are doing is not good enough to do with the data. So there are many things that need to be improved. One of the things you have to have, obviously, is some kind of unified, validated platform for simulating lots of theory models. We have to sample in some more or less representative way the whole theory space, and we have really not done that yet. We are going to use our basic platform that we want to use is MADGRAPH feeding into Pythia. This, of course, one of the ways you validate this is by using other kinds of generators and checking against these things. In fact, one of the things we found is that this lookalike analysis is very efficient at finding bugs in these codes because it shows you when there's something wrong with the physics. And you say, well, why is this doing that? And then you realize it was a bug in something. So there's a huge amount of validation work that has to be done to make this really work. And of course, putting in more models, you have to think, you know, how do you sample the theory space? So we heard a lot of interesting models here that, you know, do things that people weren't thinking about even a year ago. And so how do you actually put in enough models that you think you're sampling the theory space well enough to really do this exercise? And then the last really big thing, which is really, really hard, is what you really ought to do is you ought to unify everything I just said, all the signal analysis and validation with the background analysis and validation. So all the W+jets, Z+jets, TT bar, QCD, all that stuff, the stuff that you do for the background to make the discovery, the same kinds of people that are doing that should also be thinking about this and vice versa so that everybody is on the same page as to what's going on here. And that's the thing we're trying to do in CMS now, and it's very, very challenging to really do this right. So that is it. And I would like to close with a picture of a real CMS event from a Cosmic, and I would like to thank the organizers, Chaba and the other organizers, and the KITP for a great conference. Thank you.
Okay, questions to Joe? Everybody wants to go home. No questions?
I'll just show you. I'm just going to show you so you can tell I'm a real experimentalist. I have backup slides. I have 50 of them.
Is that a question? Okay, if not, then before we go, I would like also to say a few words. So this was the last talk of a 4-month-long workshop and a 1-week long conference. And I would like to thank the staff at the KITP, mostly Jocelyn, who has been the soul of organizing everything for the conference, and of course, you know, the director and the deputy director of the KITP, and my co-organizers, and of course, everybody who came to the conference and the workshop, and we hope that you'll have another one in 2 years where we won't be anticipating anymore. Okay? Thank you.